Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On July 17, 1971, President Richard Nixon declared what had come to be called the War on Drugs. Nixon told Congress that drug addiction had, quote, dimensions of a national emergency. He said drug abuse was public enemy number one, and he asked Congress for $84 million for what he called emergency measures. Well, fast forward 41 years, the battle rages on and the money continues to flow. The U.S. government spent over $15 billion on the war on drugs in 2010, according to DrugSense's Drug War Clock. So who profits from the drug war? And why don't we spend more time talking about all of the money that is spent on the so-called drug war? Reason Magazine's Mike Riggs says several industries owe their profit margins, market share, and in some cases, very existence to the war on drugs. These industries include drug testing, alcohol, private prisons, and addiction recovery. Each of these groups, he argues, has lobbied heavily to maintain the status quo. Mike Riggs is an associate editor at the libertarian Reason magazine and Reason.com. He writes about drug policy. His latest piece, which you can find at yourcallradio.org, is Four Industries Getting Rich Off the Drug War. And Mike joins us from Washington. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. And over the last several years, public polls have shown increasing support for drug legalization and an end to the drug war. Decriminalization just made it onto the Texas Democratic platform, and politicians in Latin America are calling for full legalization. So what does that say about the administrations in the United States? Bill Piper says they are asleep at the wheel, and when we're talking about money made off the war on drugs, we also have to look to law enforcement agencies. Bill Piper is Director of National Affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance. He develops strategies for ending the war on drugs. He also lobbies Congress in supporting in support of cutting drug war waste, preventing overdoses, and protecting state medical marijuana programs from federal interference. And Bill joins us from Washington. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Mike, let's start with you. You just wrote this piece for Reason called Four Industries Getting Rich Off the Drug War. And we did extensive research for this show, and we found very few articles. Why don't we spend more time talking about how this money is actually spent?
I think it's because we don't really spend much time talking about the drug war at all, right? I mean, it's not unusual to see on your local TV station or in a local newspaper stories about a drug raid or a drug bust or, you know, man busted for meth or whatever, you know, and these are mostly just arrest stories, and sometimes you'll read stories about sentencing, but we don't, you know, there's a whole economy that there's the shadow economy or the black market that exists for the drug trade itself, and then there's an entirely separate codependent economy that revolves around prosecuting the drug war, investigating the drug war, and treating drug users. And that second economy exists in response to prohibition and laws that we've had for the last several decades. And I'm not sure why, you know, more journalists don't cover this. I mean, I personally think that, like, just like any major newspaper is going to have, you know, an economics writer or lifestyle writers or food writers, that they should have drug policy writers. But then I'm not an editor at one of those papers. And I just think maybe that because there's a general underlying assumption that drug use is bad, that there's no point in perhaps in looking into all the things that have come about due to this assumption that drug use is bad over the last four decades.
You would think more people would ask about it specifically because we're spending so much time talking about spending in this country. But it's rarely mentioned. Bill, what would you add to that? Why don't we spend more time on this issue?
The only thing I would add would be, there's a lot of elected officials who don't want to look into this issue. Many of them are getting campaign contributions from some of the industries that make money off of the drug war, and they certainly want to stand with law enforcement and treatment professionals, et cetera. So the political class, you know, doesn't want to pull the curtain back and look at this. I'm not sure why journalists don't cover it. I suspect and agree with Mike Riggs that part of it might just be that we still have this kind of lingering drugs are bad, we need to get drugs off the street mentality that, you know, really keeps people from digging in depth. And because once you start digging, you know, it totally changes everything.
Well, and later in the show, we'll be joined by James Anthony, who's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And you also rarely hear from former members of law enforcement who are now against prohibition. So when you start to dig, Mike, as you did in your article, when you look at $15 billion spent on the war on drugs in the year 2010, what really stands out for you?
What stands out for me, I guess, going back probably for the last 10 years is the way we talk about how this money is spent. For instance, when you hear Gil Krulikowski, who's the drug czar, the head of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, he basically breaks it down into two categories, enforcement and then prevention, right? So enforcement would be the DEA, the FBI, the Marshals Service, ATF, and then grants and funding for local law enforcement agencies. And prevention has become this coverall that's everything else. And in prevention, you know, that's a big category. There's a lot of stuff in there. That's grants for rehab facilities. That's anti-drug PSAs. That's drug courts. That's all this other stuff. And so I think what we really need to do is look very closely at both of those categories. Under the enforcement category, you can see a ton of wasted money. You can look at, for instance, the money spent on finding and destroying cannabis, which is its own program run by the DEA. And when you look at that, you see that there's like a lot of money being spent on eradicating. It's a cannabis eradication project, and there's a lot of money spent on eradicating feral cannabis, which is marijuana plants that grows naturally or grows in the wild that can't even be consumed. And we spend money finding those plants, ripping them out of the ground, and then destroying them, and they can't even be used to get high. People can't even use those as drugs.
And how much is spent on that? And how often, I mean, what kind of team is working on this? I've never heard of this before.
I can't tell you how many people that the DEA actually has dedicated to this, but they release a report every year, and it's quite a bit of money. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's millions of dollars every year, and it's millions of pounds of marijuana, which a lot of which is feral. And this debate, I mean, this is drug policy reformers have been complaining about this probably for two decades, if not longer. Bill may be able to tell you that, you know, that the DEA, at the end of every year, they get to send out this report saying, look at all this marijuana we found in the United States and destroyed. So much of it is not even consumable. Then you can look at also federal grants going to local law enforcement to pay for their overtime, for them to go find these plants and destroy them. So it's just in that little segment, just in cannabis eradication, you can see a ton of wasted federal money.
And I'm assuming that a lot of that happens in California, especially in Northern California.
Yeah, I mean, that's where most of the grants, there's a very specific type of law enforcement grant that has that's pretty new. I mean, it's most of the money has actually come down under the Obama administration. You can look at some of these police departments who under Bush would get maybe $15,000 a year grants for their cannabis eradication programs. Under Obama, those grants are now $150,000, $165,000, $170,000. And this is mostly in California for very small police departments to pay for overtime for 2, 3, 4 police officers to, you know, either some of them are conducting raids on medical marijuana dispensaries, some of them are going to houses where people are growing pot plants in their closets, some of them are traipsing through national forests tearing feral marijuana plants out of the ground. So it's, and that, again, that's just a tiny little segment, but when you hear policymakers talk about where we spend money on the drug war, it's just these two giant categories with not a whole lot of nuance. It's either enforcement or prevention. And then on the prevention side, you have a lot of money going to drug courts. You have a lot of money going to rehab facilities. They get these massive, massive federal grants, you know, not just the hundreds of thousands of dollars, but in the millions of dollars. And we don't, you know, one of the things we don't talk about is on both sides of that equation, both on prevention and enforcement, you have people lobbying for that money. You have sheriff's departments hiring lobbyists to get them grants. You have rehab facilities hiring lobbyists. You have the National Association of Drug Court Professionals hiring lobbyists to get these grants. This is, you know, this money is not doled out in a vacuum.
And Bill, what would you like to add to that? What really stands out for you when you look at how $15 billion a year is spent on the war on drugs?
I mean, what stands out to me is, you know, if you really add it up, you know, you mentioned Nixon at the beginning, and you know, since 71, the U.S. has spent more than $1 trillion, you know, fighting drugs, and there's little to nothing to show for it. And so, you know, despite billions of dollars on the supply side and on the demand side, drugs are readily available in every community. They're cheap. They're potent. The harms associated with drugs, in many cases, are getting worse. Overdose fatalities, for instance, are on the rise. And so, you know, not only is it, you know, an enormous amount of money, it's wasted money. And you know, law enforcement and treatment, really, you know, they really are addicted to this money, and they both have a vested interest in the status quo. And I would argue a vested interest in failure. That, you know, if drug policy was actually successful, you know, there'd be a lot of law enforcement and treatment professionals that would be out of a job.
Well, can you elaborate on that? Because this is rarely mentioned, and that's a pretty strong statement that law enforcement is rooting for failure. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say they're rooting for failure.
Or they benefit from failure.
They certainly benefit from failure.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting. You know, you have a lot of states get federal grant money based on the number of people they arrest and based on the crime rate. So if their crime rate drops, they actually lose money. And if the crime rate goes up, they get more money. And so that seems to be backwards. It seems like you should get more money if you have an effective policy that reduces crime. And a lot of treatment, and you know, I should say the Drug Policy Alliance is all for treatment. There's definitely good treatment programs out there. Treatment's certainly a lot more effective than incarceration, but a lot of treatment is just not effective, especially the abstinence only based programs that expect, you know, addicts to just quit cold turkey and then punish them as soon as they relapse, even though relapse is a part. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think where the profiting from failure comes in is that if we readjusted our metrics and focused on, can we reduce the harm that people are causing to themselves and others, and, you know, maybe instead of trying to, you know, and it, you know, even if people are still using drugs, if they're using less drugs, well, that's certainly a success. But the more people out there that are using drugs and are committing crimes, and all the problems that we associate with drugs now, that means there's going to be more money for law enforcement and more money for treatment. Whereas if we had a more effective policy, you know, if we focus on reducing the harms associated with drugs and the harms associated with our fellow drug policies, you would see lower crime, you'd see lower death and disease, a lot less overdose fatalities, a lot less people in drug treatment, and that would mean, you know, a pretty significant loss of revenue to law enforcement and to the treatment industry and a bunch of other industries, the prison industry, the drug testing industry, you know, the private prisons, the prison guard unions. There's a significant number of industries that are making money off of the status quo.
Right.
And not just the status quo, but, you know, off of the failure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, the more law enforcement fails, the more they come to Congress and ask for more money.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the private prison industry, and I'd love you both to jump in on this. The country's largest private prison industry, Corrections Corporation of America, in its 2010 report to shareholders, says it's up to its elbows in drug war spending. CCA even trains its own drug-sniffing dogs. And a quote from the report says, "The demand for our facilities and services could be adversely affected by the relaxation of enforcement efforts, leniency in conviction or parole standards, and sentencing practices, or through the decriminalization of certain activities that are currently prescribed by our criminal laws." According to a report from the Justice Policy Institute, lobbyists for the private prison industry have pushed three strikes and truth in sentencing laws across the country, and both types of laws adversely affect drug users. Mike, what are your thoughts on private prisons, and how much do they make off of the drug war?
You know, I got a lot of interesting feedback from that particular part of the list. And I should disclose that Reason Foundation, which owns the magazine I work for, does do a lot of advising and consulting on prison privatization. One of the interesting conversations I had after this piece came out was, what are, you know, Bill was talking about incentives. And the incentives for private prisons and the incentives for prisons generally, because it's not just, you know, private prisons can get contracts from states, but publicly run prisons and state-run prisons and local prisons, they still get a lot of federal funding. And the incentive across the board throughout our entire incarceration system is filling beds, right? So if you want money for your prison, you need to have a lot of beds filled.
Right.
So one of the people I spoke to, you know, I was like, why, how do you fix this? I was like, if this is the incentive across the board, I was like, who has the incentive to, you know, how does that improve life in a prison, right? Because as of right now, public prisons, private prisons, it doesn't matter who it is, their goal is just to make sure that they have people in their beds. And one of the interesting things that came up is, like, what if the incentives were changed to prisons, both private and public, were rewarded for reducing recidivism, right? So you can actually, there's a way to change the incentives so that instead of, first of all, I mean, obviously there needs to be a policy change higher up with regards to our laws so that people don't go to prison for possession. I personally don't think people should go to prison for trafficking. I don't think they should go to prison for dealing, because, I mean, if you look at so many other things, like, not only am I allowed to drink alcohol, but somebody's allowed to sell me alcohol, and somebody's allowed to drive a truck to get alcohol to the bar, et cetera, you know. So, but the other thing is, for the people who do go to prison, prison should not be these awful, awful caged places. There should be educational opportunities there. There should be, you know, the treatment there should be better. But as of right now, A, there's no incentive for making prisons places where people actually go to recover. Prisons are just places where it's where we go to treat people that society deems, perverse. We treat them like animals. That's what prisons are. They're zoos. But there's no accountability in prisons. There's no incentive for helping the people who go there. And so, you know, not only should there be a policy change about legalization and decriminalization, but we should have policy changes, too, about changing the incentives for private prisons. Because, yes, CCA's report reflects the fact that all prisons only get money for keeping their beds filled. How would CCA's report read, Correction Corps of America's report? How would the GEO group's report, annual report to shareholders, read? How would those reports read if their incentives were getting people out of their prisons sooner and making sure that they don't come back? And I submit to you that their reports would read a lot differently.
That is Mike Riggs. He's associate editor at Reason Magazine, and he writes about drug policy. His latest piece is Four Industries Getting Rich Off the Drug War. We're also joined by Bill Piper, director of national affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance. He develops strategies for ending the drug war and lobbies Congress and the White House. And we'll talk to Bill later in the show about what that process is like. And we'd love to hear from you. Today we're talking about who's making money off of the so-called war on drugs. We're talking about $15 billion a year. Richard Nixon declared the war on drugs on July 17th, 1971, and at that time, he asked for $84 million. Today, the U.S. government spends $15 billion. So what questions do you have about how this money is spent? And if you work in any of the industries that were talking about today, if you work in law enforcement, or for example, if you're involved in recovery, if you work for the pharmaceutical industry, the alcohol industry, the prison industry, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what our guests are saying today about how this money is spent? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Bill, what are your thoughts on what Mike just said about the differences between private prisons and public prisons?
Well, I totally agree on the need to change the incentive structures, not just for private prisons, but also public prisons. They should be paid on reducing the recidivism, neither one should lose money or employees because of success. Where I might offer a little level of disagreement is just the sheer extent to which private prisons are actively lobbying state legislatures. And their new thing that they're doing is going to state offering to take over the public prison system. It'd still be state-owned, but it'd be managed by a private company. But what they're trying to put into the contract is a guarantee that the beds will be filled, which would mean that, you know, states wouldn't be able to reform their drug sentencing laws or any other criminal justice policies. And so I think changing the incentive structure certainly would help. And not just with the private prisons, but the prison guard unions, you know, who worry about jobs. If you reduce the prison population, you know, the law enforcement faces, you know, an enormous incentive to arrest as many people as possible, because that's how they're graded. How many people have you arrested? How many warrants have you served? How much drugs have you seized? How many doors have you knocked down? And if that's how you're graded, well, then that's what you're going to focus on. And Texas, a few years ago, took an interesting approach where they said, we're no longer going to grade our narcotics officers on how many people they arrest. And in fact, we're going to, you know, we're going to grade them on how well they're infiltrating crime syndicates, how close they're getting to the top, and we're going to deduct points if they're arresting drug users or low-level drug sellers. And so they take a much longer horizon with a different incentive structure. And what they found is that the number of low-level drug arrests plummeted. The drug seizures increased because they were getting closer to the drug traffickers at the top. And if you go to New York City, you know, you see a lot of marijuana arrests are about overtime. Police wait until the last hour of their shift to arrest someone for pot. It's pretty easy to arrest someone for marijuana in New York City. Wherever you go, somebody's smoking it somewhere. And it helps them get overtime. And it not only helps them get overtime, but in New York, your pension is based on the last several years of your salary and overtime. And so as a police officer gets closer to retirement, you see their arrests for marijuana go up. And so there's a whole host of incentive structures that need to be changed. And we really need to flip them to completely on their heads and get away from how many prison beds are we filling? How many people are we arresting? To a much better array of metrics, which would be: is, you know, is crime going down? Is the number of people dying going down? You know, et cetera. Treatment providers are largely graded on whether people stay abstinent. That's a wrong measurement. A better measurement would be: are people holding down a job? Have they reunited with their family? Are they safer? And, you know, so the great irony is that you may have someone who's still using drugs, but they've completely rebuilt their life. That's considered a failure. But, you know, if they've quit drugs completely, but their life is in shambles, that's considered a success. And
when we talk about marijuana arrests, minor marijuana violations, according to Normal, their latest numbers a couple years ago showed about almost 900,000. Does that sound about right?
That's about right. It's about 850,000, a little over 850,000 marijuana arrests a year. Mm. Most of that is for simple possession of small amounts of marijuana for personal use. That's like about 95% of the arrests, I think, are for simple possession. And so that's an enormous amount of people being arrested every year for possession of marijuana. And, you know, even if they don't serve a lot of, even if they just serve one day in jail,
right,
that's enough. You know, if you don't show up for work, you've lost your job. Then you have that criminal conviction.
And then and then dealing with it, and then all the people that are involved in that, and how much does that cost? We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we have full lines. We'll take your calls. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. We have a free email newsletter. Join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two that will keep you aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as opportunities to participate in station events. Just click the email newsletter link on the homepage of KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Dick Kirby, director of the new documentary, The Invisible War. This is the film that shines a spotlight on widespread rape and assault in the military. 80% of assault cases go unreported. So we'll talk about how these men and women are dealing with their trauma, what's being done about this, why isn't anyone being held accountable. The film opens in Northern California on Friday. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea or an overall comment, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about an issue that deserves far more attention, and that is, who's making money off of the war on drugs? The U.S. government spends about $15 billion a year on the so-called drug war, according to Drug Sense's Drug War Clock. So who profits from this? We're joined today by Mike Riggs, associate editor at the Libertarian Reason magazine and Reason.com. He writes about drug policy, and you can find his latest piece at our website, Four Industries Getting Rich Off of the Drug War. We're also joined by Bill Piper. He's Director of National Affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance. He develops strategies for ending the war on drugs. And we've got full lines. We'll have a free line in just a minute. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey.
Hello, Rose, and hello, Mike. Thank you, Mike and Bill, for your work. I feel that the war on drugs is a war on the people of America. And I'll have some other ones here. Gun manufacturer as well. I mean, they're arming the third world countries, the military, so that's billions of dollars in contracts. Cotton industry. Turns out that hemp could be made as fine as silk and as rough as burlap. So, you know, they don't want any competition. Pesticides. Turns out that hemp doesn't need any pesticides like cotton does, so there's billions of dollars there. The alcohol companies are fighting it, of course, because they know they're going to lose market share. And the banks launder billions of dollars in drug money every year. And the police departments, whatever funds they find, I believe that's put forward toward their retirement funds. So if they find money, that's a fine for them. So and recently, senior programs, people who want to be independent, they had their helpers taken away. The money was taken away. So the money for the war on drugs is taking money away from senior programs, helping for in-house independence. So I say, let's end the war on drugs and stop the war on the people in America.
Well, thank you. You brought up a number of points there. Mike, what about the banks? How do the banks profit off of this?
It's true that that the connection between a lot of Mexican cartels and their co-workers on stateside do use American banks to launder money, and they do use American front companies. I'm not sure, though, that they are. I mean, the banks would probably make more money if drugs were legalized, though, right? Because, yes, they're laundering money now, but if you can imagine what it would look like, the kinds of jobs it would create and the type of spending that would go on if drugs were legal in the United States, I mean, you know, we would have companies selling paraphernalia, we would have companies selling, you know, different strains of different drugs, you'd have places where you could use drugs just like we have bars. So I don't think that banks would experience any sort of net loss of capital if they had to go from laundering drug money to actually just, you know, having that money come in through a more legitimate network. But I do think the hemp thing is really interesting here because, you know, the United States has had hemp outlawed since the 1930s. And it's right. It does work well as a fabric. It's a totally, you can't get high off it. I mean, there's no rational explanation for why hemp is illegal, and it is true that, again, I don't think the cotton industry had to do anything to make hemp illegal. I think this just was another byproduct of fear over reefer madness at the beginning of the 20th century. But, you know, just because an industry doesn't actually have to lobby for drugs to stay illegal. I mean, this is kind of a point I wanted to make about the piece I wrote. An industry doesn't actually have to lobby for drugs to stay illegal to still benefit, you know. But I think that caller is right. There are tons of industries that are benefiting. I mean, you could make the case that the large pharmaceutical companies benefit because, you know, if you want a pain relief, you have to use a high grade like oxycodone or oxycodone instead of marijuana.
And I'm so glad you brought that up, because we're going to do a show about these legal drugs that are often create so many deaths across the country and rarely get talked about. The AP did an analysis recently, and they found that two legal painkillers, oxycodone and hydrocodone, caused 14,800 overdose deaths in 2008 alone.
Yeah, the high-grade prescription drugs, I mean, I don't think that those should be illegal or any more unavailable, because, again, we know that people are going to, if they want to use drugs, they can get them, they will use them, and the consequences of making those drugs illegal is that if they need help, it's much harder for them to get help without also feeling, just the awful pressure from law enforcement. But it's true. I mean, one of the things I've been looking at is as veterans with PTSD from Iraq and Afghanistan who have been begging their doctors in the Veteran Affairs Administration, saying, please, please let us use marijuana to treat PTSD instead of heavy narcotic prescription drugs, because these drugs are addictive. They turn us into shells of human beings. Marijuana makes us much more functional. And there's this sort of, I don't think that just because large pharmaceutical companies are benefiting from this legislation, that they are they're the ones keeping currently illegal drugs illegal. I'm not saying that that's the case. I can't, because there's no way for me to prove that causality.
We actually have a veteran on the line who wants to talk about medical marijuana. So let's hear from John in Berkeley. Hi, John.
Good morning. I am a Marine Corps veteran who is also a medical marijuana patient, and I'd like to discuss this issue. The VA, as it stands right now, gets a lot of heavy lobbying from the pharmaceutical industry. I'll give an example here. Anthony Principi, who was the director of Veterans Affairs under George W. Bush, is now a major lobbyist for Pfizer, a major pharmaceutical company. As far as the VA goes, Obama changed the rules about 2 years ago to where if the state has a medical marijuana statute, then the VA will allow that veteran to receive VA benefits. That never used to be the case. However, who is to say that with the current political climate that this may change? The other thing that is interesting here, too, is that as far as being a veteran goes, when you have medical marijuana, you're literally setting yourself up for the possibility that the federal government could, in time, possibly change their mind and take it away from you. The other thing I'd like to add here on another subject is that the war on drugs, as we know it, did not start under Richard Nixon. It actually started in 1965 when then California Governor Pat Brown and then later President Lyndon Johnson made LSD and other psychedelics illegal and began to speak out about the dangers of drug abuse. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of enforcement going on here in the Bay Area. I know. I was alive back then, and I saw it happen. So just because that political figure calls himself a liberal does not mean that they oppose the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. Thank you for this program.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Brief response, Bill Piper?
I couldn't agree more about having to worry about liberal elected officials. Even today you have like Senator Feinstein, for instance, from California, or Senator Schumer from New York, are just awful, really, really awful on the drug issue. So I think that the drug war is a bipartisan creation. I also think that drug policy reform is a bipartisan movement. And so, one of the things I enjoy is that, the war on drugs and opposing the war on drugs is really bringing people together across the political spectrum. It cuts across all political ideology.
Right. Well, we see that in California, that's for sure. Well, thank you for calling in, John. And now I would like to welcome James Anthony to the show. James is a former Oakland Neighborhood Law Corps attorney and current member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And he says he's seen firsthand the destructive impact of the war on drugs on both inner city neighborhoods and on police officers. And he joins us from Oakland. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So I understand you've been tuning in. What are your thoughts on what our guests have been saying today about law enforcement agencies really wanting to maintain the status quo?
Well, like all organizations, you know, they tend to become very bureaucratic, and they have a need for revenue. And it's what happens is the war on drugs is now so built in to government law enforcement culture that there's just this pernicious bureaucratic constant questing after sources of revenue. And unfortunately, forfeiture is certainly one of them. And the other one is, I mean, the definition of the war on drugs is the flow of federal tax dollars from Washington, D.C. to local law enforcement agencies. So they're both addicted to federal funding for the war on drugs, and they're also, you know, from state to state, they have a serious habit of taking people's property without due process.
And so tell us a little bit about your organization. Is there a large percentage of law enforcement officials who oppose prohibition?
Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is a wonderful organization that I first encountered about 7 years ago when I had just left the Oakland City Attorney's Office. And they formed over 10 years ago and now have well over 10,000 members of police prosecutors, judges, prison officials, people who've been involved in the war on drugs over the last 30 or 40 years and see clearly now that it's not working and that it's much more destructive than it is in any way helpful. So they continue to speak out as and when and wherever possible. We do a lot of work with Rotary clubs and Kiwanis and those kinds of social groups, and also with legislative issues.
This crosses political lines because, for example, retired police officer and anti-drug war activist Howard Wooldridge spoke recently at the CPAC Conservative Convention in Washington. You've got, you know, liberals, progressives, libertarians, conservatives, you name it, on this issue. Yet, who's really listening to you? Do you get much national media attention?
We get a fair bit of national media attention. We're well supported by the community in doing that work. Bill's organization, DPA, is very supportive of law enforcement against prohibition. Where we really need to be talking, though, we feel, you know, as much time as we spend with politicians and in the legislature, is directly to voters and to community organizations, without regard to whatever presupposition you might have about their political leanings. This is not an issue of the left or the right or the progressive or the conservative or the libertarian. Mm. It's just a matter of common sense and decency and good government. This is an utterly unworkable policy that is tearing our society apart at a very fundamental level. It corrodes the relationship between law enforcement and the public in a way which is just it's really insufferable. And it's in Oakland, which is a fine, upstanding, progressive city, as city attorney, you know, my last case was I sued a 94-year-old African-American woman in the name of the people of the state of California and basically forced her to sell her home. She'd never been arrested for anything, but, you know, the allegation was that her children and grandchildren had been dealing drugs at this property. Mm. Although, again, you know, the district attorney seemed unable to secure convictions, and so the police department came to me and said, well, you know, we'd like to sue the old lady and take her house. And any policy that leads to that form of enforcement is clearly not working and is just degrading all of us.
And did she lose her home?
Well, you know, it was the top of the market, so I let her have some time to sell that house, and she was able to go buy another one about 7 or 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in that kind of situation, the police will often make a demand for their investigation costs. And, you know, those can be somewhat exaggerated. Now, different cities will handle it differently. And I think, you know, in Oakland, we tried to minimize the transactional costs, since the supposedly the primary purpose was to abate the nuisance, to end the drug dealing at that location, and not to fill the city's coffers. But I don't think that all cities are quite as delicate about it, and I know that, you know, other prosecutors would not have taken the sort of balanced approach that I tried to strike. It's just, you know, it's a setup for a city to be able to use these drug nuisance laws to force a sale and then to take inspection costs, city attorney costs, police investigation costs out of the proceeds of that sale. It's very distasteful, and I don't think most people would be happy about it. You know, if they saw somebody who'd worked her whole life and paid off her mortgage and had never been arrested, you know, lose tens of thousands of dollars of her equity in this kind of a situation.
That is James Anthony, former Oakland Neighborhood Law Corps attorney and current member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're also joined by Mike Riggs, associate editor at Reason Magazine. His latest piece is Four Industries Getting Rich Off the Drug War. And Bill Piper is director of National Affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance. He lobbies Congress and White House to end the war on drugs. And we've got just under 10 minutes left. We have full lines. So why don't we go through a few callers and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Hi. Thank you, Rose. It's a great show. You always have great shows.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask two quick questions. One was about the lobbying. I just wondered, like, who do you talk to? Like what's the culture like around lobbying? You know, that whole thing. And then my second question was, like, I always hear about this lost money. Like, you know, from, like, DOJ or, like, you know, wherever. Like, there's a lot of lost cash just floating around the system. And I was just wondering, like, has anybody ever, like, made, like, some sort of, like, graph that shows, like, this money is here, you know, like, where this money's, like, parked out to or, like, who's receiving what and where? And
okay, so that's good. So are there any visuals? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Bill, do you want to talk about that? How does the lobbying actually work in D.C.? And can you name a few politicians who benefits from the war on drugs?
Sure. In terms of lobbying, I mean, we tend to focus on the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, which is, you know, they're the ones generally passing the drug laws, and we sometimes focus on the Appropriations Committee if we're trying to cut money or shift money around. In terms of, you know, who benefits, I mean, there's a lot of members of Congress who think acting crazy, you know, on the drug war is going to benefit them politically. I always like to point to Congressman Lamar Smith from California, from Texas, who's the Republican chair of the Judiciary Committee and hasn't met extremist drug war proposal that he doesn't like. He'll get on anything. Then on the Senate side, as I mentioned, you know, Feinstein and Schumer on the Democratic side are awful. I do want to encourage the caller, and for that matter, all the listeners, to take matters into their own hands and call or write their members of Congress or try to set up a meeting in their local office, because constituents can have a much, much, much greater impact than I can or any advocacy group in D.C., because members of Congress really pay attention you know, to what voters in a district are saying. And even if your member of Congress is just awful, you got to go in there and you got to just stay on top of them, because that's the only way things are going to change. In terms of the question about graphs, the White House Office of National Drug Policy puts out a strategy every year that is full of nice graphs. So if you go to whitehousedrugpolicy.gov, you can, and that's straight from the, you know, from the horse's mouth. That's straight from the government's mouth. And generally, it's pretty accurate. And it will also lay out what the, you know, what the Obama administration's strategy is. But all the numbers are in there.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call. And let's go to our next caller, Philip in Oakland. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I'd like to answer to two questions. One is, I have heard that
federal funds for local law enforcement is doled out on the basis of number of arrests. Can you tell me if that's true or not? If it is true, then local law enforcement has a huge incentive to pick the low-hanging fruit, which means people like marijuana users who are just possessing a little bit of marijuana. Second, I think...
And we're almost out of time.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Could you comment, please, on the terrible social destruction done by this drug? Where we have where you're creating a huge underclass, second-class citizen.
All right. Thank you, Philip. Sorry about that. Your line's pretty bad. James, can you answer that question? Are federal funds for local law enforcement agencies based on the number of arrests?
That's the usual metric is, you know, it pretends to be more complicated than that. But that's, you know, once you start funding some kind of program, there has to be some kind of metric. And what is the metric going to be? I mean, I think one of the other speakers mentioned, you know, quality of life and our people's individual lives and community lives being improved. That's great, and certainly you'd like to see that audited and taken into account somehow. But the easiest thing is to just look at statistics and rack up numbers. And so that's, you know, very often how it goes. I mean, just the jump in funding during Nixon's second term when the war on drugs launched was gigantic. Jack, the original executive director of LEAP, was a New Jersey state trooper. The New Jersey had 11 officers in their vice squad for the entire state, for the New Jersey state troopers. And then in 1 year, in 1972, their funding increased, and suddenly they had 77 officers in that vice unit. And, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to run out and rack up statistics. And that's, you know, that level of spending created a bureaucracy which then had to justify its existence. And it's frighteningly mundane that way, and it would be almost comical if it weren't for the fact that it destroys the lives of individuals, of families, of communities, and, of course, with a hugely disparate impact on communities of color.
Right. Well, thank you for the call, Philip. We have time for one more call. Let's hear from Susan in Santa Cruz. Hi, Susan.
Hey there. So real quick, I wanted to throw in, I'm a recovering addict, and I'm also certified in the state of California to be a drug counselor. So I've done that. But I also have been in harm reduction for a long time, specifically needle exchange and other types of harm reduction. And just really, I appreciate this discussion, and I would really encourage people to continue to try to have the new kind of nuanced discussions that we need to have. The camps can be kind of against one another. I've had a foot in both worlds for a long time. And I think that, you know, the discomfort that comes up around, you know, someone whose loved one has struggled with addiction can get real, or ourselves can get real touchy when I try to talk about harm reduction with people. Mm-hmm. I think that I've tried to have discussions with people about their feelings about both sides of the issue and really get some clarity around that. Because I think, you know, in terms of a movement, you know, harm reduction, decriminalization type of movement that we need to build, it's, you know, it's really surprising that otherwise progressive people really have a hard time opening up to this topic.
Right. And I've heard a lot of people say they have a hard time wrapping their arms around it or a hard time visualizing what it would look like and therefore just maintain the status quo. But you're right. We've had many shows about that. You know, what happens once drugs are legalized? What does that look like? And we'll continue having those conversations. So thank you so much for calling and sharing your personal experience. Thank you, Susan. And we've got just about 2 minutes left, so let's wrap it up. So where does this go from here? It seems like this conversation is it's out there. I mean, you've got Latin American leaders calling for the legalization of drugs. Just this week, the decriminalization just made it onto the Texas Democratic platform. You've got a number of former law enforcement officials speaking out. So where does this go from here? Mike Riggs, what are your thoughts on this?
I think that at the very least, marijuana decriminalization is now rolling downhill pretty fast. Rahm Emanuel last week endorsed decriminalization in Chicago. Rhode Island has decriminalization. I mean, we're seeing this everywhere, and it's a good thing because this is our opportunity. This is, I think, what drug reform advocates have been looking for. You know, at least since California passed the first medical marijuana law in the 90s, was an opportunity to say, like, what does this look like in a sort of relatively controlled environment? You know, a study came out of Denver this week saying that the passage of medical marijuana laws does not correlate to an increase in teen drug use. So I think this is going to be really good. We're going to be able to see. We're going to be able to imply some, you know, empirical rigor to the existence of medical marijuana laws as well as decriminalization laws. And I think what we're going to find, because it's what we've been finding so far, is that this is better. That it's better to, because people are going to use this stuff anyway, we need to look at harm reduction, as this caller just said. We need to look at mitigating the externalities of drug use. We need to look at eliminating the violence that comes when you have a shadow economy.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but Bill and James, we will definitely continue this conversation and we'll have you back. Mike Riggs is editor at the Libertarian Reason magazine. You can find his latest piece, Four Industries Getting Rich Off the Drug War, at yourcallradio.org. Bill Piper is director of national affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance, and James Anthony is a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What is being done about sexual assault in the U.S. military? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Dick Kirby, director of the documentary The Invisible War. The film shines a spotlight on widespread rape and assault in the military. 80% of assault cases go unreported. So how are these men and women dealing with their trauma? Join us at 10 or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. The film is a call to action, so who should be held accountable? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.